Tender is the Night, Disc 8.
At Zug, Mademoiselle got out and left them. The divers approached the Adjiri fair through a menagerie of mammoth steamrollers that made way for them. Dick parked the car, and as Nicole looked at him without moving, he said, "Come on, Darl." Her lips drew apart into a sudden, awful smile, and his belly quailed. But as if he hadn't seen it, he repeated, "Come on, so the children can get out." "Oh, I'll come, all right," she answered, tearing the words from some story, spinning itself out inside her, too fast for him to grasp. "Don't worry about that, I'll come." "Then come." She turned from him as he walked beside her, but the smile still flickered across her face, derisive and remote. Only when Lanier spoke to her several times did she manage to fix her attention upon an object, a Punch and Judy show, and to orient herself by anchoring to it. Dick tried to think what to do. The dualism in his views of her, that of the husband, that of the psychiatrist, was increasingly paralyzing his faculties. In these 6 years, she had several times carried him over the line with her, disarming him by exciting emotional pity or by a flow of wit, fantastic and disassociated, so that only after the episode did he realize, with the consciousness of his own relaxation from tension, that she had succeeded in getting a point against his better judgment. A discussion with Topsy about the Guignol, as to whether the punch was the same punch they had seen last year in Cannes, having been settled, the family walked along again between the booths under the open sky. The women's bonnets, perching over velvet vests, the bright spreading skirts of many cantons, seemed demure against the blue and orange paint of the wagons and displays. There was the sound of a whining, tinkling hoochie-coochie show. Nicole began to run very suddenly, so suddenly that for a moment Dick did not miss her. Far ahead, he saw her yellow dress twisting through the crowd, an ochre stitch along the edge of reality and unreality, and started after her. Secretly she ran, and secretly he followed. As the hot afternoon went shrill and terrible with her flight, he had forgotten the children. Then he wheeled and ran back to them, drawing them this way and that by their arms, his eyes jumping from booth to booth. "Madame," he cried to a young woman behind a white lottery wheel, "est-ce que je peux laisser ces petits avec vous 2 minutes? C'est très urgent. Je vous donnerai 10 francs. Mais oui." He headed the children into the booth. "Alors, restez avec cette gentille dame." "Oui, Dick." He darted off again, but he had lost her. He circled the merry-go-round, keeping up with it till he realized he was running beside it, staring always at the same horse. He elbowed through the crowd in the buvette. Then, remembering a predilection of Nicole's, he snatched up an edge of a fortune-teller's tent and peered within. A droning voice greeted him. "La septième fille d'une septième fille née sur les rives de Nil. Entrez, monsieur." Dropping the flap, he ran along toward where the plaisance terminated at the lake, and a small ferris wheel revolved slowly against the sky. There he found her. She was alone in what was momentarily the top boat of the wheel, and as it descended he saw that she was laughing hilariously. He slunk back in the crowd, a crowd which, at the wheel's next revolution, spotted the intensity of Nicole's hysteria.
"Regardez-moi ça! Regarde donc cette Anglaise!"
Down she dropped again. This time the wheel and its music were slowing, and a dozen people were around her car, all of them impelled by the quality of her laughter to smile in sympathetic idiocy. But when Nicole saw Dick, her laughter died. She made a gesture of slipping by and away from him, but he caught her arm and held it as they walked away. "Why did you lose control of yourself like that?"
"You know very well why."
"No, I don't. That's just preposterous. Let me loose. That's an insult to my intelligence. Don't you think I saw that girl look at you? That little dark girl? Oh, this is farcical. A child, not more than 15. Don't you think I saw?
Stop here a minute and quiet down.
They sat at a table, her eyes in a profundity of suspicion, her hand moving across her line of sight as if it were obstructed. I want a drink. I want a brandy.
You can't have brandy. You can have a bock if you want it.
Why can't I have a brandy?
We won't go into that. Listen to me. This business about a girl is a delusion. Do you understand that word?
It's always a delusion when I see what you don't want me to see.
He had a sense of guilt, as in one of those nightmares where we are accused of a crime which we recognize as something undeniably experienced, but which upon waking we realize we have not committed. His eyes wavered from hers. I left the children with a gypsy woman in a booth. We ought to get them.
Who do you think you are? She demanded. Svengali?
15 minutes ago they had been a family. Now, as she was crushed into a corner by his unwilling shoulder, he saw them all, child and man, as a perilous accident.
We're going home. Home! She roared in a voice so abandoned that its louder tones wavered and cracked. And sit and think that we're all rotting and the children's ashes are rotting in every box I open? That filth!
Almost with relief, he saw that her words sterilized her. And Nicole, sensitized down to the corium of the skin, saw the withdrawal in his face. Her own face softened, and she begged, "Help me! Help me, Dick!" A wave of agony went over him. It was awful that such a fine tower should not be erected, only suspended, suspended from him. Up to a point that was right. Men were for that, beam and idea, girder and logarithm. But somehow Dick and Nicole had become one and equal. Not opposite and complementary. She was Dick, too. The drought in the marrow of his bones. He could not watch her disintegrations without participating in them. His intuition rilled out of him as tenderness and compassion. He could only take the characteristically modern course to interpose. He would get a nurse from Zurich to take her over tonight.
You can help me.
Her sweet bullying pulled him forward off his feet.
You've helped me before. You can help me now.
I can only help you the same old way.
Someone can help me.
Maybe so. You can help yourself most. Let's find the children. There were numerous lottery booths with white wheels. Dick was startled when he inquired at the first and encountered blank disavowals. Evil-eyed, Nicole stood apart, denying the children, resenting them as part of a downright world she sought to make amorphous. Presently Dick found them, surrounded by women who were examining them with delight like fine goods, and by peasant children staring.
Merci, monsieur. Ah, monsieur est trop généreux. C'était un plaisir, monsieur. Madame, au revoir, mes petits.
They started back with a hot sorrow streaming down upon them. The car was weighted with their mutual apprehension and anguish, and the children's mouths were grave with disappointment. Grief presented itself in its terrible, dark, unfamiliar color. Somewhere around Zug, Nicole, with a convulsive effort, reiterated a remark she had made before about a misty yellow house set back from the road that looked like a painting not yet dry, but it was just an attempt to catch at a rope that was playing out too swiftly. Dick tried to rest. The struggle would come presently at home, and he might have to sit a long time, restating the universe for her. A schizophrène is well named as a split personality. Nicole was alternately a person to whom nothing need be explained and one to whom nothing could be explained. it was necessary to treat her with active and affirmative insistence, keeping the road to reality always open, making the road to escape harder going. But the brilliance, the versatility of madness is akin to the resourcefulness of water seeping through, over, and around a dike. It requires the united front of many people to work against it. He felt it necessary that this time Nicole cure herself. He wanted to wait until she remembered the other times and revolted from them. In a tired way, he planned that they would again resume the regime relaxed a year before. He had turned up a hill that made a shortcut to the clinic, and now, as he stepped on the accelerator for a short straightaway run parallel to the hillside, the car swerved violently left, swerved right, tipped on two wheels, and, as Dick, with Nicole's voice screaming in his ear, crushed down the mad hand clutching the steering wheel, righted itself, swerved once more, and shot off the road. It tore through low underbrush, tipped again, and settled slowly at an angle of 90 degrees against a tree. The children were screaming, and Nicole was screaming and cursing and trying to tear at Dick's face. Thinking first of the list of the car and unable to estimate it, Dick bent away Nicole's arm, climbed over the top side, and lifted out the children. Then he saw the car was in a stable position. Before doing anything else, he stood there shaking and panting. "You!" he cried. She was laughing, hilariously, unashamed, unafraid, unconcerned. No one coming on the scene would have imagined that she had caused it. She laughed as after some mild escape of childhood. "You were scared, weren't you?" she accused him. "You wanted to live." She spoke with such force that in his shocked state Dick wondered if he had been frightened for himself, but the strained faces of the children, looking from parent to parent, made him want to grind her grinning mask into jelly. Directly above them, half a kilometer by the winding road, but only 100 yards climbing, was an inn. One of its wings showed through the wooded hill. "Take Topsy's hand," he said to Lanier, "like that, tight, and climb up that hill. See the little path? When you get to the inn, tell them, 'La voiture de va est cassée. Someone must come right down.'" Lanier, not sure what had happened, but suspecting the dark and unprecedented, asked, "What will you do, Dick?" "We'll stay here with the car." Neither of them looked at their mother as they started off. "Be careful crossing the road up there. Look both ways," Dick shouted after them. He and Nicole looked at each other directly, their eyes like blazing windows across a court of the same house. Then she took out a compact, looked in its mirror, and smoothed back the temple hair. Dick watched the children climbing for a moment until they disappeared among the pines halfway up. Then he walked around the car to see the damage and plan how to get it back on the road. In the dirt he could trace the rocking course they had pursued for over 100 feet. He was filled with a violent disgust that was not like anger. In a few minutes the proprietor of the inn came running down. "My God!" he exclaimed. "How did it happen? Were you going fast? What luck! Except for that tree, you'd have rolled downhill." Taking advantage of Emile's reality, the wide black apron, the sweat upon the rolls of his face, Dick signaled to Nicole in a matter-of-fact way to let him help her from the car. Whereupon she jumped over the lower side, lost her balance on the slope, fell to her knees, and got up again. As she watched the men trying to move the car, her expression became defiant. Welcoming even that mood, Dick said, "Go and wait with the children, Nicole." Only after she had gone did he remember that she had wanted cognac, and that there was cognac available up there. He told Emile never mind about the car. They would wait for the chauffeur and the big car to pull it up onto the road. Together they hurried up to the inn. 16. I want to go away, he told Franz. For a month or so, for as long as I can. Why not, Dick? That was our original arrangement. It was you who insisted on staying. If you and Nicole... I don't want to go away with Nicole. I want to go away alone. This last thing knocked me sideways. If I get 2 hours sleep and 24, it's one of Zwingli's miracles. You wish a real leave of abstinence. The word is absence. Look here, if I go to Berlin, to the Psychiatric Congress, could you manage to keep the peace? For 3 months, she's been all right, and she likes her nurse. My God, you're the only human being in this world I can ask this of. Franz grunted, considering whether or not he could be trusted to think always of his partner's interest. In Zurich the next week, Dick drove to the airport and took the big plane for Munich. Soaring and roaring into the blue, he felt numb, realizing how tired he was. A vast, persuasive quiet stole over him, and he abandoned sickness to the sick, sound to the motors, direction to the pilot. He had no intention of attending so much as a single session of the Congress. He could imagine it well enough, new pamphlets by Bleuler and the elder Forel that he could much better digest at home, the paper by the American who cured dementia praecox by pulling out his patient's teeth or cauterizing their tonsils, the half-derisive respect with which this idea would be greeted for no more reason than that America was such a rich and powerful country. The other delegates from America, red-headed Schwartz with his saint's face and his infinite patience in straddling two worlds, as well as dozens of commercial alienists with hangdog faces who would be present partly to increase their standing and hence their reach for the big plums of the criminal practice, partly to master novel sophistries that they could weave into their stock in trade to the infinite confusion of all values. There would be cynical Latins, and some man of Freud's from Vienna. Articulate among them would be the great Jung, bland, super vigorous, on his rounds between the forests of anthropology and the neuroses of schoolboys. At first there would be an American cast to the Congress, almost Rotarian in its forms and ceremonies. Then the closer-knit European vitality would fight through, and finally the Americans would play their trump card. The announcement of colossal gifts and endowments, of great new plants and training schools, and in the presence of the figures the Europeans would blanch and walk timidly. But he would not be there to see. They skirted the Vorarlberg Alps, and Dick felt a pastoral delight in watching the villages. There were always four or five in sight, each one gathered around a church. It was simple looking at the earth from far off, simple as playing grim games with dolls and soldiers. This was the way statesmen and commanders and all retired people looked at things. Anyhow, it was a good draught of relief. An Englishman spoke to him from across the aisle, but he found something antipathetic in the English lately. England was like a rich man after a disastrous orgy who makes up to the household by chatting with them individually when it's obvious to them that he is only trying to get back his self-respect in order to usurp his former power. Dick had with him what magazines were available on the station quays. The Century, the Motion Picture, L'Illustration, and the Fliegende Blätter. But it was more fun to descend in his imagination into the villages and shake hands with the rural characters. He sat in the churches as he sat in his father's church in Buffalo, amid the starchy must of Sunday clothes. He listened to the wisdom of the Near East, was crucified, died, and was buried in the cheerful church, and once more worried between 5 or 10 cents for the collection plate, because of the girl who sat in the pew behind. The Englishman suddenly borrowed his magazines with a little small change of conversation, and Dick, glad to see them go, thought of the voyage ahead of him. Wolf-like under his sheep's clothing of long, staple Australian wool, he considered the world of pleasure. The incorruptible Mediterranean with sweet old dirt caked in the olive trees. The peasant girl near Savona with a face as green and rose as the color of an illuminated missal. He would take her in his hands and snatch her across the border. But there he deserted her. He must press on toward the isles of Greece, the cloudy waters of unfamiliar ports, the lost girl on shore, the moon of popular songs. A part of Dick's mind was made up of the tawdry souvenirs of his boyhood. Yet in that somewhat littered 5 and 10, he had managed to keep alive the low, painful fire of intelligence.
XVII. Tommy Barbon was a ruler. Tommy was a hero. Dick happened upon him in the Marienplatz in Munich, in one of those cafes where small gamblers diced on tapestry mats. The air was full of politics and the slap of cards. Tommy was at a table, laughing his martial laugh. M-ba-ha-ha! M-ba-ha-ha! As a rule, he drank little. Courage was his game, and his companions were always a little afraid of him. Recently, an eighth of the area of his skull had been removed by a Warsaw surgeon and was knitting under his hair, and the weakest person in the café could have killed him with a flip of a knotted napkin. "This is Prince Chilichev," a battered, powder-gray Russian of 50, "and Mr. McKibben, and Mr. Hannon." The latter was a lively ball of black eyes and hair, a clown, and he said immediately to Dick, "The first thing before we shake hands, what do you mean by fooling around with my aunt?" "Why, I..." "You heard me. What are you doing here in Munich, anyhow?" "M-ba-ha-ha," laughed Tommy. "Haven't you got aunts of your own? Why don't you fool with them?" Dick laughed, whereupon the man shifted his attack. "Now, let's not have any more talk about aunts. How do I know you didn't make up the whole thing? Here you are, a complete stranger with an acquaintance of less than half an hour, and you come up to me with a cock-and-bull story about your aunts. How do I know what you have concealed about you?" Tommy laughed again. Then he said, good-naturedly but firmly, "That's enough, Carly. Sit down, Dick. How are you? How's Nicole?" He did not like any man very much, nor feel their presence with much intensity. He was all relaxed for combat. As a fine athlete, playing secondary defense in any sport is really resting much of the time, while a lesser man only pretends to rest and is at a continual and self-destroying nervous tension. Hannon, not entirely suppressed, moved to an adjoining piano and, with recurring resentment on his face whenever he looked at Dick, played chords, from time to time muttering, "Your aunts," and in a dying cadence, "I didn't say aunts anyhow, I said pants." "Well, how are you?" repeated Tommy. "You don't look so..." He fought for a word. "So jaunty as you used to. So spruce, you know what I mean." The remark sounded too much like one of those irritating accusations of waning vitality, and Dick was about to retort by commenting on the extraordinary suits worn by Tommy and Prince Chilichev, suits of a cut and pattern fantastic enough to have sauntered down Beale Street on a Sunday, when an explanation was forthcoming. "I see you are regarding our clothes," said the prince. "We have just come out of Russia." "These were made in Poland by the court tailor," said Tommy. "That's a fact. Piłsudski's own tailor." "You've been touring?" Dick asked. They laughed, the prince inordinately, meanwhile, clapping Tommy on the back. "Yes, we have been touring. That's it, touring. We have made the grand tour of all the Russias, in state." Dick waited for an explanation. It came from Mr. McKibben in two words. "They escaped." "Have you been prisoners in Russia?" "It was I," explained Prince Chilichev, his dead yellow eyes staring at Dick. "Not a prisoner, but in hiding." Did you have much trouble getting out? Some trouble. We left 3 Red Guards dead at the border. Tommy left 2. He held up 2 fingers like a Frenchman. I left 1. That's the part I don't understand, said Mr. McKibben. Why they should have objected to your leaving. Hannon turned from the piano and said, winking at the others, Mac thinks a Marxian is somebody who went to St. Mark's school. It was an escape story in the best tradition. An aristocrat hiding 9 years with a former servant and working in a government bakery. The 18-year-old daughter in Paris who knew Tommy Barbon. During the narrative, Dick decided that this parched papier-mâché relic of the past was scarcely worth the lives of 3 young men. The question arose as to whether Tommy and Chilichev had been frightened. When I was cold, Tommy said, I always get scared when I'm cold. During the war, I was always frightened when I was cold. McKibben stood up. I must leave. Tomorrow morning I'm going to Innsbruck by car with my wife and children, and the governess.
I'm going there tomorrow, too, said Dick.
Oh, are you? Exclaimed McKibben. Why not come with us? It's a big Packard, and there's only my wife and my children and myself, and the governess. I can't possibly. Of course, she's not really a governess, McKibben concluded, looking rather pathetically at Dick. As a matter of fact, my wife knows your sister-in-law, Baby Warren. But Dick was not to be drawn in a blind contract. I've promised to travel with 2 men. Oh, McKibben's face fell. Well, I'll say goodbye. He unscrewed 2 blooded wire hairs from a nearby table and departed. Dick pictured the jammed Packard pounding toward Innsbruck with the McKibbens and their children and their baggage and yapping dogs and the governess. The paper says they know the man who killed him, said Tommy. But his cousins did not want it in the papers because it happened in a speakeasy. What do you think of that? It's what's known as family pride. Hannon played a loud chord on the piano to attract attention to himself. I don't believe his first stuff holds up, he said. Even barring the Europeans, there are 12 Americans can do what North did. It was the first indication Dick had that they were talking about Abe North. The only difference is that Abe did it first, said Tommy. I don't agree, persisted Hannon. He got the reputation for being a good musician because he drank so much that his friends had to explain him away somehow. What's this about Abe North? What about him? Is he in a jam? Didn't you read the Herald this morning?
No.
He's dead. He was beaten to death in a speakeasy in New York. He just managed to crawl home to the racket club to die.
Abe North?
Yes, sure.
Abe North?
Dick stood up. Are you sure he's dead?
Hannon turned around to McKibben.
It wasn't the racket club he crawled to. It was the Harvard Club. I'm sure he didn't belong to the racket.
The paper said so, McKibben insisted.
It must have been a mistake, I'm quite sure.
Beaten to death in a speakeasy.
But I happen to know most of the members of the racket club, said Hannon. It must have been the Harvard Club.
Dick got up, Tommy too. Prince Chilichev started out of a wan study of nothing, perhaps of his chances of ever getting out of Russia, a study that had occupied him so long that it was doubtful if he could give it up immediately, and joined them in leaving. Abe North beaten to death? On the way to the hotel, a journey of which Dick was scarcely aware, Tommy said,
We're waiting for a tailor to finish some suits so we can get to Paris. I'm going into stockbroking, and they wouldn't take me if I showed up like this. Everybody in your country is making millions. Are you really leaving tomorrow? We can't even have dinner with you. It seems the prince had an old girl in Munich. He called her up, but she'd been dead 5 years. And we're having dinner with the 2 daughters. The prince nodded. Perhaps I could have arranged for Dr. Diver.
No, no, said Dick hastily.
He slept deep and awoke to a slow, mournful march passing his window. It was a long column of men in uniform wearing the familiar helmet of 1914,
thick men in frock coats and silk hats, burghers, aristocrats, plain men. It was a society of veterans going to lay wreaths on the tombs of the dead. The column marched slowly with a sort of swagger for a lost magnificence, a past effort, a forgotten sorrow. The faces were only formally sad, but Dick's lungs burst for a moment with regret for Abe's death, and his own youth of 10 years ago. He reached Innsbruck at dusk, sent his bags up to a hotel, and walked into town. In the sunset, the Emperor Maximilian knelt in prayer above his bronze mourners. A quartet of Jesuit novices paced and read in the university garden. The marble souvenirs of old sieges, marriages, anniversaries faded quickly when the sun was down. And he had Erbsensuppe with Wurstchen cut up in it, drank 4 helles of Pilsner, and refused a formidable dessert known as Kaiserschmarrn. Despite the overhanging mountains, Switzerland was far away. Nicole was far away. Walking in the garden later when it was quite dark, he thought about her with detachment, loving her for her best self. He remembered once when the grass was damp and she came to him on hurried feet, her thin slippers drenched with dew. She stood upon his shoes, nestling close, and held up her face, showing it as a book open at a page. "Think how you love me," she whispered. "I don't ask you to love me always like this, but I ask you to remember. Somewhere inside me, there'll always be the person I am tonight." But Dick had come away for his soul's sake, and he began thinking about that. He had lost himself. He could not tell the hour when, or the day, or the week, the month, or the year. Once he had cut through things, solving the most complicated equations as the simplest problems of his simplest patients. Between the time he found Nicole flowering under a stone on the Zürichsee and the moment of his meeting with Rosemary, the spear had been blunted. Watching his father's struggles in poor parishes had wedded a desire for money to an essentially unacquisitive nature. It was not a healthy necessity for security. He had never felt more sure of himself, more thoroughly his own man, than at the time of his marriage to Nicole. Yet he had been swallowed up like a gigolo, and somehow permitted his arsenal to be locked up in the Warren safety deposit vaults. There should have been a settlement in the continental style, but it isn't over yet. I've wasted 8 years teaching the rich the ABCs of human decency. But I'm not done. I've got too many unplayed trumps in my hand. He loitered among the fallow rose bushes and the beds of damp, sweet, indistinguishable fern. It was warm for October, but cool enough to wear a heavy tweed coat buttoned by a little elastic tape at the neck. A figure detached itself from the black shape of a tree, and he knew it was the woman whom he had passed in the lobby coming out. He was in love with every pretty woman he saw now, their forms at a distance, their shadows on a wall. Her back was toward him as she faced the lights of the town. He scratched a match that she must have heard, but she remained motionless. Was it an invitation, or an indication of obliviousness? He had long been outside of the world of simple desires and their fulfillments, and he was inept and uncertain. For all he knew, there might be some code among the wanderers of obscure spas by which they found each other quickly. Perhaps the next gesture was his. strange children should smile at each other and say, "Let's play." He moved closer. The shadow moved sideways. Possibly he would be snubbed like the scapegrace drummers he had heard of in youth. His heart beat loud in contact with the unprobed, undissected, unanalyzed, unaccounted for. Suddenly he turned away, and as he did, the girl, too, broke the black frieze she made with the foliage, rounded a bench at a moderate but determined pace, and took the path back to the hotel. With a guide and two other men, Dick started up the Bierkaspitze next morning. It was a fine feeling once they were above the cowbells of the highest pastures. Dick looked forward to the night in the shack, enjoying his own fatigue, enjoying the captaincy of the guide, feeling a delight in his own anonymity. But at midday the weather changed to black sleet and hail and mountain thunder. Dick and one of the other climbers wanted to go on, but the guide refused. Regretfully, they struggled back to Innsbruck to start again tomorrow. After dinner and a bottle of heavy local wine in the deserted dining room, he felt excited, without knowing why, until he began thinking of the garden. He had passed the girl in the lobby before supper, and this time she had looked at him and approved of him. But it kept worrying him. Why? When I could have had a good share of the pretty women of my time for the asking, why start that now? With a wraith, with a fragment of my desire. Why? His imagination pushed ahead. The old asceticism, the actual unfamiliarity, triumphed. God, I might as well go back to the Riviera and sleep with Janice Caricamento or the Wilburhazy girl. To belittle all these years with something cheap and easy? He was still excited, though, and he turned from the veranda and went up to his room to think. Being alone in body and spirit begets loneliness, and loneliness begets more loneliness. Upstairs he walked around, thinking of the matter and laying out his climbing clothes advantageously on the faint heater. He again encountered Nicole's telegram, still unopened, with which diurnally she accompanied his itinerary. He had delayed opening it before supper, perhaps because of the garden. It was a cablegram from Buffalo, forwarded through Zurich. "Your father died peacefully tonight. Holmes." He felt a sharp wince at the shock. A gathering of the forces of resistance. Then it rolled up through his loins and stomach and throat. He read the message again. He sat down on the bed, breathing and staring, thinking first the old selfish child's thought that comes with the death of a parent. How will it affect me now that this earliest and strongest of protections is gone? The atavism passed, and he walked the room still, stopping from time to time to look at the telegram. Holmes was formerly his father's curate, but actually, and for a decade, rector of the church. How did he die? Of old age, he was 75. He had lived a long time. Dick felt sad that he had died alone. He had survived his wife and his brothers and sisters. They were cousins in Virginia, but they were poor and not able to come north, and Holmes had had to sign the telegram. Dick loved his father. Again and again, he referred judgments to what his father would probably have thought or done. Dick was born several months after the death of two young sisters, and his father, guessing what would be the effect on Dick's mother, had saved him from a spoiling by becoming his moral guide. He was of tired stock, yet he raised himself to that effort. In the summer, father and son walked downtown together to have their shoes shined. Dick in his starched duck sailor suit, his father always in beautifully cut clerical clothes. And the father was very proud of his handsome little boy. He told Dick all he knew about life, not much, but most of it true, simple things, matters of behavior that came within his clergyman's range. Once in a strange town, when I was first ordained, I went into a crowded room and was confused as to who was my hostess. Several people I knew came toward me, but I disregarded them because I had seen a gray-haired woman sitting by a window far across the room. I went over to her and introduced myself. After that, I made many friends in that town. His father had done that from a good heart. His father had been sure of what he was. With a deep pride of the two proud widows who had raised him to believe that nothing could be superior to good instincts, honor, courtesy, and courage. The father always considered that his wife's small fortune belonged to his son, and in college and in medical school sent him a check for all of it 4 times a year. He was one of those about whom it was said with smug finality in the Gilded Age, very much the gentleman, but not much get up and go about him. Dick sent down for a newspaper. Still pacing to and from the telegram open on his bureau, he chose a ship to go to America. Then he put in a call for Nicole in Zurich, remembering so many things as he waited, and wishing he had always been as good as he had intended to be. For an hour, tied up with his profound reaction to his father's death, the magnificent facade of the homeland, the harbor of New York, seemed all sad and glorious to Dick, but once ashore the feeling vanished. Nor did he find it again in the streets or the hotels or the trains that bore him first to Buffalo and then south to Virginia with his father's body. Only as the local train shambled into the low-forested clayland of Westmoreland County did he feel once more identified with his surroundings. At the station, he saw a star he knew and a cold moon bright over Chesapeake Bay. He heard the rasping wheels of buckboards turning, the lovely, fatuous voices, the sound of sluggish primeval rivers flowing softly under soft Indian names. Next day at the churchyard, his father was laid among 100 divers, Dorseys, and Hunters. It was very friendly leaving him there with all his relations around him. Flowers were scattered on the brown, unsettled earth. Dick had no more ties here now, and did not believe he would come back. He knelt on the hard soil. These dead, he knew them all, their weather-beaten faces with blue flashing eyes, the spare, violent bodies, the souls made of new earth in the forest-heavy darkness of the 17th century. Goodbye, my father. Goodbye. All my fathers. On the long-roofed steamship piers, one is in a country that is no longer here and not yet there. The hazy yellow vault is full of echoing shouts. There are the rumble of trucks and the clump of trunks, the strident chatter of cranes, the first salt smell of the sea. One hurries through, even though there's time. The past, the continent, is behind. The future is the glowing mouth in the side of the ship. The dim, turbulent alley is too confusedly the present. Up the gangplank, and the vision of the world adjusts itself, narrows. One is a citizen of a commonwealth smaller than Andorra, no longer sure of anything. The men at the purser's desk are as oddly shaped as the cabins. Disdainful are the eyes of voyagers and their friends. Next, the loud, mournful whistles, the portentous vibration, and the boat, the human idea, is in motion. The pier and its faces slide by, and for a moment the boat is a piece accidentally split off from them. The faces become remote, voiceless. The pier is one of many blurs along the waterfront. The harbor flows swiftly toward the sea. With it flowed Albert McKisco, labeled by the newspapers as its most precious cargo. McKisco was having a vogue. His novels were pastiches of the work of the best people of his time, a feat not to be disparaged. And in addition, he possessed a gift for softening and debasing what he borrowed, so that many readers were charmed by the ease with which they could follow him. Success had improved him and humbled him. He was no fool about his capacities. He realized that he possessed more vitality than many men of superior talent, and he was resolved to enjoy the success he had earned. "I've done nothing yet," he would say. "I don't think I've got any real genius, but if I keep trying, I may write a good book." Fine dives have been made from flimsier springboards. The innumerable snubs of the past were forgotten. Indeed, his success was founded psychologically upon his duel with Tommy Barbon, upon the basis of which, as it withered in his memory, he had created afresh a new self-respect. Spotting Dick Diver the second day out, he eyed him tentatively, then introduced himself in a friendly way and sat down. Dick laid aside his reading, and after the few minutes that it took to realize the change in McKisco, the disappearance of the man's annoying sense of inferiority, found himself pleased to talk to him. McKisco was well informed on a range of subjects wider than Goethe's. It was interesting to listen to the innumerable facile combinations that he referred to as his opinions. They struck up an acquaintance, and Dick had several meals with them. The McKiscos had been invited to sit at the captain's table, but with nascent snobbery they told Dick that they couldn't stand that bunch. Violet was very grand now, decked out by the grand couturière, charmed about the little discoveries that well-bred girls make in their teens. She could indeed have learned them from her mother in Boise, but her soul was born dismally in the small movie houses of Idaho. And she had had no time for her mother. Now she belonged, together with several million other people, and she was happy, though her husband still shushed her when she grew violently naive. The McKiscos got off at Gibraltar. Next evening in Naples, Dick picked up a lost and miserable family of two girls and their mother in the bus from the hotel to the station. He had seen them on the ship. An overwhelming desire to help, or to be admired, came over him. He showed them fragments of gaiety. Tentatively he bought them wine, with pleasure saw them begin to regain their proper egotism. He pretended they were this and that, and, falling in with his own plot, and drinking too much to sustain the illusion, and all this time the women thought only that this was a windfall from heaven. He withdrew from them as the night waned, and the train rocked and snorted at Cassino and Frosinone. After weird American partings in the station at Rome, Dick went to the Hotel Quirinal, somewhat exhausted. At the desk he suddenly stared and upped his head. As if a drink were acting on him, warming the lining of his stomach, throwing a flush up into his brain, he saw the person he had come to see, the person for whom he had made the Mediterranean crossing. Simultaneously, Rosemary saw him, acknowledging him before placing him. She looked back, startled, and, leaving the girl she was with, she hurried over. Holding himself erect, holding his breath, Dick turned to her. As she came across the lobby, her beauty all groomed, like a young horse dosed with black seed oil and hoops varnished, shocked him awake. But it all came too quick for him to do anything except conceal his fatigue as best he could. To meet her starry-eyed confidence, he mustered an insincere pantomime implying, "You would turn up here, of all the people in the world." Her gloved hands closed over his on the desk. "Dick, we're making the grandeur that was Rome. At least we think we are. We may quit any day." He looked at her hard, trying to make her a little self-conscious so that she would observe less closely his unshaven face, his crumpled and slept-in collar. Fortunately, she was in a hurry. "We begin early because the mists rise at 11. Phone me at 2. In his room, Dick collected his faculties. He left a call for noon, stripped off his clothes, and dove, literally, into a heavy sleep. He slept over the phone call, but awoke at 2, refreshed. Unpacking his bag, he sent out suits and laundry. He shaved, lay for half an hour in a warm bath, and had breakfast. The sun had dipped into the Via Nazionale, and he let it through the portieres with a jingling of old brass rings. Waiting for a suit to be pressed, he discovered from the Corriere della Sera that Una novella di Sinclair Lewis, Wall Street, nella quale autore analizza la vita sociale di una piccola città americana. Then he tried to think about Rosemary. At first he thought nothing. She was young and magnetic, but so was Topsy. He guessed that she had had lovers and had loved them in the last 4 years. Well, you never knew exactly how much space you occupied in people's lives. Yet from this fog his affection emerged. The best contacts are when one knows the obstacles and still wants to preserve a relation. The past drifted back, and he wanted to hold her eloquent giving of herself in its precious shell till he enclosed it, till it no longer existed outside him. He tried to collect all that might attract her. It was less than it had been 4 years ago. 18 might look at 34 through a rising mist of adolescence, but 22 would see 38 with discerning clarity. Moreover, Dick had been at an emotional peak at the time of the previous encounter. Since then there had been a lesion of enthusiasm. When the valet returned, he put on a white shirt and collar and a black tie with a pearl. The cords of his reading glasses passed through another pearl of the same size that swung a casual inch below. After sleep, his face had resumed the ruddy brown of many Riviera summers, and to limber himself up he stood on his hands on a chair until his fountain pen and coins fell out. At 3 he called Rosemary and was bidden to come up. Momentarily dizzy from his acrobatics, he stopped in the bar for a gin and tonic. "Hi, Dr. Diver." Only because of Rosemary's presence in the hotel did Dick place the man immediately as Collis Clay. He had his old confidence and an air of prosperity and big, sudden jowls. "Do you know Rosemary's here?" Collis asked. "I ran into her. I was in Florence and I heard she was here, so I came down last week. You'd never know Mama's little girl." He modified the remark. "I mean, she was so carefully brought up, and now she's a woman of the world, if you know what I mean. Believe me, has she got some of these Roman boys tied up in bags, and how?" "You studying in Florence?" "Me? Sure, I'm studying architecture there. I go back Sunday. I'm staying for the races." With difficulty, Dick restrained him from adding the drink to the account he carried in the bar, like a stock market report. 20. When Dick got out of the elevator, he followed a tortuous corridor and turned at length toward a distant voice outside a lighted door. Rosemary was in black pajamas. A luncheon table was still in the room. She was having coffee. "You're still beautiful," he said. "A little more beautiful than ever. Do you want coffee, youngster?" "I'm sorry I was so unpresentable this morning." "You didn't look well. You all right now? Want coffee?" "No, thanks." "You're fine again. I was scared this morning. Mother's coming over next month if the company stays. She always asks me if I've seen you over here, as if she thought we were living next door. Mother always liked you. She always felt you were someone I ought to know." "Well, I'm glad she still thinks of me." "Oh, she does," Rosemary reassured him. "A very great deal." "I've seen you here and there in pictures," said Dick. once I had Daddy's girl run off just for myself. I have a good part in this one if it isn't cut. She crossed behind him, touching his shoulder as she passed. She phoned for the table to be taken away and settled in a big chair. I was just a little girl when I met you, Dick. Now I'm a woman. I want to hear everything about you. How is Nicole and Lanier and Topsy? They're fine. They often speak of you. The phone rang. While she answered it, Dick examined two novels, one by Edna Ferber, one by Albert McKisco. The waiter came for the table. Bereft of its presence, Rosemary seemed more alone in her black pajamas. I have a caller. No, not very well. I've got to go to the costumer's for a long fitting. No, not now. As though with the disappearance of the table, she felt released. Rosemary smiled at Dick, that smile as if they two together had managed to get rid of all the trouble in the world, and were now at peace in their own heaven. That's done, she said. Do you realize I've spent the last hour getting ready for you? But again the phone called her. Dick got up to change his hat from the bed to the luggage stand, and in alarm Rosemary put her hand over the mouthpiece of the phone. You're not going? No. When the communication was over, he tried to drag the afternoon together, saying, I expect some nourishment from people now. Me too, Rosemary agreed. The man that just phoned me once knew a second cousin of mine. Imagine calling anybody up for a reason like that. Now she lowered the lights for love. Why else should she want to shut off his view of her? He sent his words to her like letters, as though they left him some time before they reached her. Hard to sit here and be close to you and not kiss you. Then they kissed, passionately, in the center of the floor. She pressed against him and went back to her chair. It could not go on being merely pleasant in the room. Forward or backward. When the phone rang once more, he strolled into the bedchamber and lay down on her bed, opening Albert McKisco's novel. Presently, Rosemary came in and sat beside him. You have the longest eyelashes, she remarked. We are now back at the junior prom. Among those present are Miss Rosemary Hoyt, the eyelash fancier. She kissed him, and he pulled her down so that they lay side by side. And then they kissed till they were both breathless. Her breathing was young and eager and exciting. Her lips were faintly chapped but soft in the corners. When they were still limbs and feet and clothes, struggles of his arms and back and her throat and breasts, she whispered, No, not now. Those things are rhythmic. Disciplined, he crushed his passion into a corner of his mind, but bearing up her fragility on his arms until she was poised half a foot above him, he said lightly, Darling, that doesn't matter. Her face had changed with his looking up at it. There was the eternal moonlight in it. That would be poetic justice if it should be you, she said. She twisted away from him, walked to the mirror, and boxed her disarranged hair with her hands. Presently, she drew a chair close to the bed and stroked his cheek. "Tell me the truth about you," he demanded. "I always have." "In a way, but nothing hangs together." They both laughed, but he pursued. "Are you actually a virgin?"
"No," she sang. "I've slept with 640 men, if that's the answer you want."
"It's none of my business."
"Do you want me for a case in psychology?"
"Looking at you as a perfectly normal girl of 22, living in the year 1928, I guess you've taken a few shots at love."
"It's all been abortive," she said. Dick couldn't believe her.
He could not decide whether she was deliberately building a barrier between them or whether this was intended to make an eventual surrender more significant.
"Let's go walk in the Pincho," he suggested. He shook himself straight in his clothes and smoothed his hair. A moment had come and somehow passed. For 3 years, Dick had been the ideal by which Rosemary measured other men. And inevitably his stature had increased to heroic size. She did not want him to be like other men, yet here were the same exigent demands, as if he wanted to take some of herself away, carry it off in his pocket. Walking on the greensward between cherubs and philosophers, fawns and falling water, she took his arm snugly, settling into it with a series of little readjustments, as if she wanted it to be right because it was going to be there forever. She plucked a twig and broke it, but she found no spring in it. Suddenly, seeing what she wanted in Dick's face, she took his gloved hand and kissed it. Then she cavorted childishly for him until he smiled and she laughed, and they began having a good time. "I can't go out with you tonight, darling, because I promised some people a long time ago, but if you'll get up early, I'll take you out to the set tomorrow." He dined alone at the hotel, went to bed early, and met Rosemary in the lobby at 6:30. Beside him in the car, she glowed away, fresh and new in the morning sunshine. They went out through the Porta San Sebastiano, and along the Appian Way, until they came to the huge set of the Forum, larger than the Forum itself. Rosemary turned him over to a man who led him about the great props, the arches and tiers of seats and the sanded arena. She was working on a stage which represented a guard room for Christian prisoners, and presently they went there and watched Nicotera, one of many hopeful Valentinos, strut and pose before a dozen female captives, their eyes melancholy and startling with mascara. Rosemary appeared in a knee-length tunic. "Watch this," she whispered to Dick. "I want your opinion. Everybody that's seen the rushes says..."
"What are the rushes?"
"When they run off what they took the day before. They say it's the first thing I've had sex appeal in."
"I don't notice it."
"You wouldn't, but I have."
Nicotera, in his leopard skin, talked attentively to Rosemary, while the electrician discussed something with the director, meanwhile leaning on him. Finally, the director pushed his hand off roughly and wiped a sweating forehead, and Dick's guide remarked,
"He's on the hop again, and how?"
"Who?" asked Dick, but before the man could answer, the director walked swiftly over to them.
"Who's on the hop? You're on the hop yourself!"
He spoke vehemently to Dick as if to a jury.
"When he's on the hop, he always thinks everybody else is. And how?"
He glared at the guide a moment longer, then he clapped his hands.
"All right, everybody on the set."
It was like visiting a great, turbulent family. An actress approached Dick and talked to him for 5 minutes under the impression that he was an actor recently arrived from London. Discovering her mistake, she scuttled away in panic. The majority of the company felt either sharply superior or sharply inferior to the world outside, but the former feeling prevailed. They were people of bravery and industry. They were risen to a position of prominence in a nation that for a decade had wanted only to be entertained. The session ended as the light grew misty. A fine light for painters, but for the camera not to be compared with the clear California air. Nicotera followed Rosemary to the car and whispered something to her. She looked at him without smiling as she said goodbye. Dick and Rosemary had luncheon at the Castelli dei Cesari, a splendid restaurant in a high terraced villa overlooking the ruined Forum of an undetermined period of the decadence. Rosemary took a cocktail and a little wine, and Dick took enough so that his feeling of dissatisfaction left him. Afterward, they drove back to the hotel, all flushed and happy, in a sort of exalted quiet. She wanted to be taken, and she was.
and what had begun with a childish infatuation on a beach was accomplished. At last. 21. Rosemary had another dinner date, a birthday party for a member of the company. Dick ran into Collis Clay in the lobby, but he wanted to dine alone and pretended an engagement at the Excelsior. He drank a cocktail with Collis, and his vague dissatisfaction crystallized as impatience. He no longer had an excuse for playing truant to the clinic. This was less an infatuation than a romantic memory. Nicole was his girl. Too often he was sick at heart about her, yet she was his girl. Time with Rosemary was self-indulgence. Time with Collis was nothing plus nothing. In the doorway of the Excelsior, he ran into Baby Warren. Her large, beautiful eyes, looking precisely like marbles, stared at him with surprise and curiosity. "I thought you were in America, Dick. Is Nicole with you?" "I came back by way of Naples." The black band on his arm reminded her to say, "I am so sorry to hear of your trouble." Inevitably, they dined together. "Tell me about everything," she demanded. Dick gave her a version of the facts, and Baby frowned. She found it necessary to blame someone for the catastrophe in her sister's life. "Do you think Dr. Domler took the right course with her from the first?" "There's not much variety in treatment anymore. Of course, you try to find the right personality to handle a particular case." "Dick, I don't pretend to advise you or to know much about it, but don't you think a change might be good for her? To get out of that atmosphere of sickness and live in the world like other people." "But you were keen for the clinic," he reminded her. "You told me you'd never feel really safe about her. That was when you were leading that hermit's life on the Riviera, up on a hill, way off from anybody. I didn't mean to go back to that life. I meant, for instance, London. The English are the best balanced race in the world."
"They are not," he disagreed.
"They are. I know them, you see. I meant it might be nice for you to take a house in London for the spring season. I know a dove of a house in Talbot Square you could get furnished. I mean, living with sane, well-balanced English people." She would have gone on to tell him all the old propaganda stories of 1914 if he had not laughed and said, "I've been reading a book by Michael Arlen, and if that's..." She ruined Michael Arlen with a wave of her salad spoon. "He only writes about degenerates. I mean the worthwhile English." As she thus dismissed her friends, they were replaced in Dick's mind only by a picture of the alien, unresponsive faces that peopled the small hotels of Europe. "Of course, it's none of my business," Baby repeated, as a preliminary to a further plunge. "But to leave her alone in an atmosphere like that..."
"I went to America because my father died."
"I understand that. I told you how sorry I was." She fiddled with the glass grapes on her necklace. "But there's so much money now, plenty for everything, and it ought to be used to get Nicole well."
"For one thing, I can't see myself in London."
"Why not? I should think you could work there as well as anywhere else."
He sat back and looked at her. If she had ever suspected the rotted old truth, the real reason for Nicole's illness, she had certainly determined to deny it to herself, shoving it back in a dusty closet like one of the paintings she bought by mistake. They continued the conversation in the Ulpia, where Collis Clay came over to their table and sat down, and a gifted guitar player thrummed and rumbled "Suona fanfara mia" in the cellar piled with wine casks. "It's possible that I was the wrong person for Nicole," Dick said. "Still, she would probably have married someone of my type, someone she thought she could rely on, indefinitely."
"You think she'd be happier with somebody else?" Baby thought aloud suddenly. "Of course, it could be arranged."
Only as she saw Dick bend forward with helpless laughter did she realize the preposterousness of her remark.
Oh, you understand, she assured him. Don't think for a moment that we're not grateful for all you've done, and we know you've had a hard time.
For God's sake, he protested. If I didn't love Nicole, it might be different.
But you do love Nicole, she demanded in alarm.
Collis was catching up with the conversation now, and Dick switched it quickly.
Suppose we talk about something else, about you, for instance. Why don't you get married? We heard you were engaged to Lord Paley, the cousin of the...
Oh, no, she became coy and elusive. That was last year.
Why don't you marry?
Dick insisted stubbornly.
I don't know. One of the men I loved was killed in the war, and the other one threw me over.
Tell me about it. Tell me about your private life, baby, and your opinions.
You never do. We always talk about Nicole.
Both of them were Englishmen. I don't think there's any higher type in the world than a first-rate Englishman, do you? If there is, I haven't met him. This man... Oh, it's a long story. I hate long stories, don't you?
And how? Said Collis.
Why, no, I like them if they're good.
That's something you do so well, Dick. You can keep a party moving by just a little sentence or a saying here and there. I think that's a wonderful talent.
It's a trick, he said gently. That made three of her opinions he disagreed with.
Of course, I like formality. I like things to be just so and on the grand scale. I know you probably don't, but you must admit it's a sign of solidity in me.
Dick did not even bother to dissent from this.
Of course, I know people say Baby Warren is racing around over Europe, chasing one novelty after another, and missing the best things in life, but I think, on the contrary, that I'm one of the few people who really go after the best things. I've known the most interesting people of my time. Her voice blurred with the tinny drumming of another guitar number, but she called over it. I've made very few big mistakes.
Only the very big ones, baby.
She had caught something facetious in his eye, and she changed the subject. It seemed impossible for them to hold anything in common. But he admired something in her. And he deposited her at the Excelsior with a series of compliments that left her shimmering.
This ends Disc 8.